Welcome to The Climate Fix. My name is Asim. On this show, we shine a spotlight on nonprofits, academics, corporations, startups, anyone working on a solution to the climate problem.
Batteries, I'm very skeptical about batteries for both long-term and large quantity electrical storage. I know Elon Musk talks about batteries that he has in Australia, which supposedly can supply 30,000 homes, except I did a bit of a calculation and the answer is he can supply 30,000 homes, but only for half an hour.
That was Professor Avril MacDonald, OBE, an emeritus professor at the University of Reading and professor of inclusion and equality at the University of Birmingham. She also has honorary doctorates by the University of York and Kingston University, and an OBE, which is an Officer of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire, a reward given to her by the Queen in 2015 for services to women in science. On top of all of that, Avril was awarded the International Bragg Medal and Prize by the Institute of Physics London, the accolade of Women of Outstanding Achievement in Science, and the prestigious Plastics Industry Award for personal contribution to the industry. Avril is currently Deputy Master of the Worshipful Company of Fuelers, working alongside His Royal Highness Prince Edward and the Earl of Wessex as Royal Master. Now, a Worshipful Company is a very British thing. They are comprised of London's ancient and modern trade associations and guilds. The Fuelers now cover the whole energy sector, but has its roots in coal. Throughout her time as Deputy Master, she is championing future energy solutions to decarbonise the UK, with a particular emphasis on using hydrogen to decarbonise the UK's heating system and to make decarbonised heavy goods vehicles a reality. She's also focusing the Fuelers' charitable work on supporting students from disadvantaged backgrounds to consider STEM qualifications as a route into the energy sector through three main charities: Teen Tech, Generating Genius, and Small Peace Trust. Professor Avril was a fascinating guest. We covered all sorts of different topics related to hydrogen. I learned a lot, and I think you will too. Let's dive in. So hi, Avril. Welcome to the show. What is the climate problem that you're solving?
Right, so the thing that I've spotted that I'm campaigning on at the moment is decarbonising the UK's heating system. And the point is, we actually talk an awful lot about electricity and we're all very knowledgeable about wind farms, about solar. And frequently you hear about the fact that we've generated an awful lot of our electricity using renewables. All great stuff. I have nothing against that at all. I'm also very keen on electric vehicles to an extent. But nobody talks about heating. And in the UK, we are rather odd compared with most of the world. We use gas. Gas is a fossil fuel. A third of our carbon emissions are from our central heating. And people hardly think about it. So I'm trying to raise people's awareness of the fact that however well-intentioned they are, their gas central heating is a problem. Mm. And we can't go electric. You cannot convert the UK's heating to electric. My solution is hydrogen.
That's fascinating. And that's something, as somebody who's lived in the UK, it's actually surprising to me. It was a surprise to me to realise that it's not everybody in the world has gas piped to their house. It's very, very, very normal for every single house in the UK to have gas piped to it. I have a gas boiler downstairs. And that's something I didn't realize was an unusual characteristic of the UK versus the rest of the world. And you said a third of the UK emissions are from heating our houses?
Houses and other buildings, yeah. But the majority is gas-based. And you're quite right. We have a colossal network of gas pipes under the UK. Most countries don't have that. The Netherlands similarly does. But it's because we have access to the North Sea gas. Oh. Other countries, Spain, France, Germany, Italy, they've never invested in a gas infrastructure for the simple reason they don't have access to North Sea gas, natural gas. So their infrastructure is much more strongly electric. You know about France and their nuclear power stations. Their houses are heated with electricity. America, on the other side of the world, predominantly electricity. We didn't go that way. We use electricity for lighting, clearly, and for machines, but not for our heating. And that's the thing we have to bear in mind. What we shouldn't do as the UK is assume that the solution that, say, Germany is following would suit us where we are. It isn't quite the same. We have to look at the solution that suits our infrastructure and then work with it. So that's why we're a bit different. We discovered North Sea gas. We put in 3,500 kilometres of gas pipes. Lo and behold, you accept a gas boiler as the most natural thing in your house to heat it up.
And that's a great, I never even considered the way the heating systems of countries evolved from the availability of energy sources. Because then I think what you just explained to me why the majority of America is heated and cooled through kind of air conditioning units, I believe at least, because it's electricity based. That makes complete sense.
Yeah. You also have to bear in mind another issue that we built within the UK an electricity generating capacity that suits our needs. So to bring a few figures into this, if we were to generate electricity to the maximum extent, that's using all of the power stations, solar, nuclear, wind, everything, we can, in the UK, generate round about 60 gigawatts. Now, that sounds a lot. 60,000 million watts, or 60 million kilowatts. Actually, think about it. That's only 1 kilowatt per person. We cannot generate more than 1 kilowatt per person. And that kilowatt per person is not what you use in your house. It's what is used on your behalf in offices, street lighting, traffic lights, shops, you name it. There's not a lot of spare electricity. Our headroom, as they call it, isn't very big. And when we had the beast from the east a couple of years ago, we were all at home trying to keep warm. Incredible storm. Incredible storm. We were terribly cold. We were all at home. The UK government had to pay businesses to switch off their demand for electricity because we needed it at home. And the last thing we would have tolerated would have been power cuts. Now, if we contrast ourselves with Italy, broadly a similar sort of population. Actually, they tend to use, on average, about the same sort of amount of electricity, but they're able to generate 120 gigawatts compared with our 60 gigawatts. They have a lot spare. What that means is if they need spare because they're going to, for example, buy electric cars to recharge, the spare capacity is there. In the UK, we don't have any spare. And it worries me when people talk about, let's all have electric cars. How are we going to charge them? Notwithstanding the fact that if you don't have off-street parking, it's a bit difficult anyway, but we can't physically generate all the electricity. Now, let's take that one step further. Imagine somebody now says, oh, you're not allowed gas central heating. It's a fossil fuel. You can understand that. And then you say, let's all have electric central heating, like Germany, like America. We can't generate that much electricity physically as a country. We can't. And then there's another issue. We have round about 23 million homes using our gas central heating, 23 million. If we were to convert them to electric central heating, that means ripping out the whole of the central heating system, all the radiators and boilers, replacing them with an electric system, £15,000 per household. That's a bit of a bombshell for a start. If we were to start today and we were to convert every house in the UK from gas to electricity, we would have to convert one house every 44 seconds to get it all done by 2050.
Wow.
It's a colossal job. So my point is, from where we're starting, the electric solution doesn't really suit where we are. But conveniently, because we've got gas pipes, the hydrogen solution is absolutely ready-made for us. And I think we should be talking about hydrogen as our solution to the heating issue, alongside the need for green electricity, because that's the only way we're going to decarbonize.
So talk to me about the hydrogen solution. What does that look like? Because we don't have a grid. We don't have a grid of pipes in the UK, is my understanding. So how does that look?
Right. Okay, so there's not an absolutely national grid. There is a grid, but each town is relatively self-contained with its gas pipes. That's because of historical reasons. If we go back pre-1960s, each town had a town gas generating plant. It generated its town gas. It therefore has a town supply. And we used to have, you won't remember, but I'm old enough to remember, huge gas cylinders in every town, and the town gas would have been made from coal. It was predominantly hydrogen, but it was a bit dirty because it was made of coal. So we used that for decades, hundreds of years, in fact. And we then changed from that to natural gas when natural gas was discovered under the North Sea in the 60s. And I remember that transition. Somebody came round to tweak your boiler or to tweak your cooker to make it able to burn natural gas, which is predominantly methane, rather than town gas, which is predominantly hydrogen. Now, that's how we got to where we are. Large numbers of pipes, but each town relatively self-contained. And then a central spine of high-pressure gas pipes running up and down the country, but don't worry about that. Now, what we could do, and this is not speculative, this is actually a plan already in place. We could convert the town, a town at a time, go into people's houses, tweak their boiler, tweak their hob, and then send hydrogen down their pipes into their house. They would notice no difference. Everything would continue to work normally. The only difference is there'd be absolutely zero carbon emissions from their heating compared with now, which is significant. And you can do it a town at a time. So we are already planning for Leeds in the north to be converted as a pilot, but many other towns are interested. And the people driving this are actually the gas suppliers. Oh. Northern Gas Distribution Networks, as a business, sees this as a business initiative, not as simply something to do because people think green is good. They actually see it as a benefit to themselves and to the community. And say they see how they will do this as a business proposition.
How do they see it as a business? Is it because the cost of securing that natural gas is not as competitive as hydrogen? Actually, the creation of hydrogen, is it competitive to the gathering of natural gas?
Well, this is the whole point. This is the interesting point. At the moment, up until 2000, we were self-sufficient in gas. Mm. We actually acquired our gas from the North Sea, everything we needed. In fact, we could sell some. We are now able to produce only about half of the gas that we need because the wells are going dry. People are not happy with the concept of fracking, so self-sufficiency in gas from fracking is not acceptable. We're having to buy it in, predominantly from Russia, but equally from Qatar. It's brought in ships as liquefied natural gas. But equally, as time goes on, money will be the be-all and end-all of this. It will cost more money to bring in gas from overseas. Clearly, it makes more sense if we can actually produce our own heating resource, hydrogen. They also see that the actual cost of conversion is modest compared with the cost of putting up electricity generating stations to increase our generation.
So you're talking about the cost of converting boilers from...
Boilers, yes. The physical cost of converting people's houses is modest compared with the cost of going to an electric system. And clearly it keeps them in business. But that's going to bring you to the question of, okay, where's this hydrogen coming from? This is where it gets clever. There's all sorts of options here. But one option for the hydrogen is clearly you can take water, you can put electric current through it, you can split the hydrogen oxygen. Now, the clever thing about this is if you have a wind farm, say in the North Sea, it's generating electricity in the middle of the night when we can't use it. At the moment, it's wasted. Quite recently, one of the green electricity companies was paying their customers to use electricity on a Sunday because they had more than they could use. Imagine instead of wasting it, you actually use that spare green electricity that's being generated overnight to convert water to hydrogen. There's your hydrogen supply pretty much for free. It's going to be generating the electricity anyway. You don't need it. You convert the hydrogen, your water to hydrogen, and you store the hydrogen. They're already looking at storing the spare hydrogen in no longer used salt mines off the Teesside coast, off Deeside. So that's already been looked at by various engineering companies.
As in you liquefy the hydrogen?
No, the hydrogen is just in the caverns. But you don't liquefy hydrogen in the sense of cooling it down and pressurizing it to a very low temperature. That's not a sensible way. If you did want to store it as a liquid form, you'd store it as ammonia. Oh. And that is a way of transporting it around the world in ships. If you wanted to do that, if, for example, we produce so much hydrogen, we could export it to other places that needed it.
Ammonia,
you do it, you
because ammonia isn't a gas at room temperatures.
It's a liquid, yeah. But it's NH3. It's got an awful lot of H's in it. Okay, so you can transport it easily. The tankers that currently bring us liquefied natural gas from Qatar could be taking our hydrogen to Qatar for them to use. Wouldn't that be a fun business proposition? So that's possibility number one. Really neat way of storing green electricity in the form of hydrogen, which is then injected into our gas pipes for us to use in the winter when we're heating our homes. That's number one. But the other thing that's really clever, we're still getting gas out of the North Sea. You can actually decarbonize methane. Methane is CH4. Okay. So one carbon, four hydrogens. You can decarbonize the methane. So you keep the carbon. You have four hydrogens. There's your hydrogen for your heating systems. You've now got carbon.
As in you split the carbon out without turning it into CO2. You take the carbon.
Correct. Right. Yes. What you do is you split it out and you sequester it into a carbonate, okay, which broadly looks, it's a solid, it looks like a house brick. The clever thing here is you are taking methane, basically a carbon-based fuel that you can't burn anymore. You take the carbon away, you've got hydrogen, a totally clean fuel that you can burn in your central heating systems. You sequester the hydrogen, you sequester the carbon into your carbonate, which looks like a house brick. What do we need in this country? Houses. Everyone's a winner. It couldn't be better, could it? Free electricity generating the hydrogen from water, free house bricks from generating the hydrogen from methane.
Yeah.
I rest my case.
I think if I was the judge, you will definitely win that court case.
Thank you. I can't see what's not to like. Yeah. It sounds so straightforward. So it's getting there.
I think that's the thing I find with a lot of the green solutions. I've rarely found a green solution which wasn't cheaper, more efficient, and wins on kind of many different areas. I love what you described at the start. I had no idea that our gas supply had run low, and it kind of reminded me of the point that I think a number of other countries that are pursuing kind of renewable projects are because of energy independence. And I'd love to say people are doing it because of, you know, they care about the environment and kind of other concerns. I'm sure that's part of it, but energy independence, so our desire to not be dependent upon another country for our energy needs, is driving something. And I know I read I listened to a statistic the other day, which is three out of every four people on this planet live in a country which is a net importer of energy, which means that you know, that those countries don't want to do that anymore, and renewables is a great source of that. And yes. Offshore wind farms, you're in the water, so you have water right there. You just perhaps desalinate them, and the idea of curtailment, which is another thing I learned about renewable energy, which is that if you have too much electricity, it's a problem. It's a problem for the grid. That's what blackouts. It threw me when I realized that's. I thought blackout was something else. No, blackout is too much electricity. So you actually want to stop wind turbines creating electricity when you don't need them. So that's an amazing use case for that electricity, is to turn it into hydrogen.
Let me add another issue here. Let me add another point here. From a business perspective, if you own a wind farm, you clearly want to be selling your electricity. What you don't want is have a wind farm where nobody needs your electricity. In the UK, we use a hell of a lot more energy in the winter because it's cold, mainly on our heating, than we do in the summer. If you're the owner of a wind farm that's only allowed to sell its electricity to customers in the winter because they don't need it in the summer, they don't use aircon in this country like they do in other countries, they only need the extra energy in the winter. There is no good business proposition for a business that is only viable for half the year. And for the other half the year, if they are generating, it is a problem. So the concept we just build more wind farms, actually from a business perspective, is not such a simple idea as you would think. You don't want to be the person with a wind farm that only gets called upon once a year.
So it's a case of storing. And normally when I think of storage or I hear about storage solutions, For solar and wind, they're normally considered to be very short term. You know, we want to store this energy until 8 hours later when people need it. You're actually just described something long-term storage of energy and batteries, which is typically what people talk about when they talk about storage. It's for short-term storage. Hydrogen, it sounds like. Oh, is it not? Yeah.
Yes, you're right. Hydrogen, once you've made the hydrogen, it just stays there until you need it. Batteries, I'm very skeptical about batteries for both long-term and large quantity electrical storage. I know Elon Musk talks about batteries that he has in Australia, which supposedly can supply 30,000 homes, except I did a bit of a calculation, and the answer is he can supply 30,000 homes, but only for half an hour. If you do the calculations, it's not as straightforward. And on top of that, the physical size of the battery is enormous. We're talking swimming pools. And on top of that, the batteries they use, they're not lithium oxide like the ones in your phone. They tend to be lead acid. Do you really want a swimming pool full of sulfuric acid near your home? Not such a good idea. I'm not a fan of batteries. Lithium, they're fine for mobile, such as for your phone. Not so very good for substantial quantities. I think it's a red herring. I think the battery idea is not going to be the big solution to storage. And I think chemical storage as hydrogen has got to be a way forward, even for countries that may not use gas to burn in their boilers. Because think of another thing. If you have your hydrogen, you've made it out of free electricity. All you have to do is combine it back with oxygen. You get electricity out in a fuel cell.
Yes, that's something. I'd love to dig into that a little bit more. Yeah.
So this is the point. So my solution of everybody's boiler gets tweaked so it burns hydrogen, that's only stage one. If later on they need to change their boiler because it's got a bit old, instead of changing it for another boiler that burns hydrogen, you change it for a fuel cell that both creates your heat and your electricity. We can take houses off the grid. Yeah. We no longer have to generate electricity centrally. At the moment, we're used to a big power station and large power lines coming across the country distributing electricity to us. We could go to a localized generation system where you actually have your hydrogen supplying your heat and your electricity. So there you go.
So that's a realization I had very recently, actually, because I'd heard the term hydrogen fuel cell. And in my mind, I think because as growing up as a kid going to school, hydrogen was something you burnt. And I knew when you burnt it, you got water. When I heard about hydrogen fuel cells, first of all, I just assumed that at some level in there, there's like a turbine, there's some sort of combustion going on. But it's a pure, if I understand correctly, it's a pure chemical reaction that generates electricity. Same as like perhaps a normal kind of battery I have in my, like the AA batteries or whatever that I have. In my devices.
It's remarkably similar to a battery. The only thing is you provide a fuel continuously. You don't have to recharge the battery. I can do a very simplistic description for you, which is a bit difficult for a sound-based recording because I tend to wave my hands around when I'm doing this, but I'll give it a go. What you have to imagine is a bit of a sandwich, okay? And in the middle of the sandwich is a polymer. It's the electrolyte. It's the clever bit. Okay, so that's your trade secret bit. On the one side of your sheet of polymer, you feed hydrogen. And on the other side of your polymer, you leave it open to the atmosphere so that it can access oxygen. Now, this is the clever bit. Hydrogen, as you know, is a proton and an electron. That's it. But what happens next is the neat bit. The protons go through the polymer and they come to the other side. The electrons can't. Now, quite why? Nobody really understands, except protons, being the larger of the two particles, now go through the polymer. Electrons, the smaller of the two particles, trapped on the other side where the hydrogen was. Now, that's a potential difference. You've got a charge difference, positive and negative. Nature doesn't like that. As soon as you connect a wire between where the electrons are and the protons are, the electrons will whiz through the wire to join their parent proton. That's called an electric current. That will drive any motor or any device, any light that you want. That is a fuel cell. Now, when the proton and electron rejoin to make hydrogen on the far side of the polymer, they then meet the oxygen, hydrogen plus oxygen, water. The only output from a fuel cell is water. And if you come across hydrogen-powered vehicles, they work on fuel cells. They generate their own electricity, not from a battery. They're exactly the same as a battery-powered car. You just don't need a battery. You need a fuel cell, and you need a tank of hydrogen.
Yep.
So in fact, my solution of hydrogen to fuel all of the houses can also fuel all of the cars. You never need to plug your car in for recharging. You simply have your fuel cell, a canister of hydrogen, off you go. And the next brilliant bit is this. Battery-powered vehicles are great if they're tiny. They're not so good for HGVs. Hydrogen can drive buses, trucks, HGVs, you name it. We are not limited by the size of the vehicle. You just pump hydrogen in, big fuel cell, electric, no emissions, and no need to generate more electricity and plug your car in overnight.
I did a little bit of research before this podcast, and I discovered the same thing, that hydrogen, that one of the challenges with battery powered, or traditional battery powered the right term? I don't know. Non-fuel cell battery powered vehicles is the charging time. So the charging time is you know, for an individual, for me at home, and my car is probably just parked outside for a few hours every day. I don't mind. That's fine. I'm happy to charge it. But for a commercial trucking business, for instance, they don't want to leave the trucks to charge overnight. They want those trucks on the road all the time. So it sounds to me like you could just pump in almost the same way you put petrol or gasoline in the car. You just pump in hydrogen. And then that is an instant battery source, an instant electric. So refueling essentially is very, very fast.
Yeah.
And it's lighter.
Absolutely. Well, yes, it is lighter. And the point is exactly what you say. It's exactly what we do today. So refueling your car would be no different from driving to a petrol station, sticking the tube into your car. 30 seconds later, you've got enough to drive off. Exactly the same. The problem with cars at the moment is the range is not huge.
Hydrogen
if
cars.
It's as much as... Yeah. No, this is battery-powered electric vehicles, what you describe as traditional battery-powered vehicles, the one we are now used to. The range isn't huge. It's a couple of hundred miles at best, and you then have to recharge. And it could be, imagine this, you come to a recharging station. One, you can't be certain it works. Two, you actually might end up with a situation where you're having to sit for half an hour in a dark, deserted corner of a car park on your own in the middle of the night. Not very safe. So that's an issue. The recharging time is a problem, but the trucks themselves can't actually travel that far anyway. You are limited in range. These trucks do hundreds of miles in a day. You can't afford to be stopping every so often for recharging. So that the hydrogen fuel cell is far more reasonable. Plus, of course, you say about, you know, you'll quite happily sit for several hours while your car recharges while you're at home. If you need to recharge in a short time, you need an incredible flow of energy. Now, let me take you back to the numbers I used beginning. The UK provides, on average, a kilowatt per person, typically, right? One of the early cars, the Nissan Leaf, would charge at 8 kilowatts. Mm. Take several hours, 8 kilowatts to fill your battery up. Some of the cars, like the Audi, which is a fast charging car, e-tron, the Audi e-tron, it has something like 150 kilowatts.
Wow.
So you are using 150 people's worth of electricity to charge your car, which is fine if you're the only one in the street. Not so good if there are several neighbours who plug in simultaneously. Our local distribution networks for electricity, if you like, the cables under the street, are not robust enough to tolerate that much electricity flowing under your streets. They were not put in the 1960s with the vision everybody would have fast charging electric cars. So our whole infrastructure would have to be renewed. Now, this would be colossally expensive, as well as being very disruptive, digging up everybody's street to put in far more robust electric cables in order to transmit enough electricity for cars and possibly electric heating if we go down the all-electric route. So again, we face a barrier in the UK. We are just not set up for an all-electric solution.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah, because that's something that people don't quite consider about electricity. Unlike water, perhaps, where you turn it on and you see a pressure and sometimes the pressure is less. So we kind of, I suppose, conceptually understand that there's a limited rate which is shared. We just assume electricity is available at almost infinite rates for everybody at any given time, where it's not. It's something that it's just not possible.
And this is the issue. It's how much can we generate, number one, limit, and number two, what is the... reliability of actually transmitting it locally into people's houses You know, we didn't put in an infrastructure that can transmit energy at that sort of rate. So if somebody's prepared to dig up everybody else's street and pay a fortune for putting in a whole new set of national grid, fine. But I think a lot of people would be very upset at the tax rises that are required for that.
Mm, yeah, indeed. So what exactly is happening in Leeds? You mentioned they are now... is the hydrogen as a gaseous form going to be pumped into people's houses?
Okay, so I can't claim to be an absolute expert. If somebody really wants to look at this, it's worth them looking at the website. It's Northern Gas Distribution Networks is the instigator of the project, and it's called the Leeds Citygate H21 project. So people need to look at that if they want to know more details. But my broad and very superficial understanding is that the whole of the business case and the whole of the safety case has been made in great detail to the government in the UK with a view to Leeds as an entity, the town, the whole of the town, being converted, all of the boilers, all of the hobs, so that they can start feeding hydrogen into the grid that is Leeds. Once that has shown itself to work, the plan is to roll it out to other towns. And clearly, Northern Gas Distribution Networks will be the provider of the gas. So as we pay our gas providers now, they will pay Northern Gas and they will receive hydrogen. So it will be a seamless transition, and they need a reasonably substantially sized town to prove the product broadly. Yeah. And that's what's happening. And my understanding is plans are for within the next 3 or 4 years for this to take off.
In Leeds,
it should be fairly straightforward.
In Leeds.
But once it's been proven in Leeds, what's to stop it moving further afield? And it's a huge business opportunity for people who wish to start generating hydrogen or storing it. And clearly, we are already looking at people buying boilers that are hydrogen ready. So instead of having to swap your little burner over, it's already there.
Yeah. So it needs a slightly different
bit like having your
burner.
The burner. Basically, you've got to have the gas go through at three times the rate.
Right.
Because hydrogen, being very light and very low energy density, needs to go through faster to get the right amount of heat out of it for your central heating or cooking.
And would this be the same type of... If I had a hydrogen-powered car, would this be the same gas that I put in my car, or is it...
It can be the same gas, yes. So the same pipeline could provide your gas, but it's unlikely you would fill your gas from your house. You'd probably go to a filling station because it needs to go in at slightly higher pressure into your car. But the plan is your car has a, I'll call it a canister rather than a tank, and you refill the canister by putting a pipe. You screw it in place, you clearly, otherwise the hydrogen escapes. Screw it in place, fill it in broadly the same length of time as it takes to fill a petrol car. And the hydrogen resides in the canister. Now, people are sometimes worried about this. They say, you know, it might explode. There's been a lot of tests on this. The hydrogen, again, I don't know the details of quite how the chemistry works on this, but broadly, there are fibrils within the canister. It is not open. It's not empty. And the hydrogen resides in there in a way that means that it is safe and it doesn't have to be held at very low temperatures under very high pressure. So it won't explode. In fact, if anything, battery-powered cars are more likely to go up in flames than hydrogen-powered cars. And if you do have a battery-powered car go up in flames, you can't put the burning out. It can't use water on it. It's a lithium fire. Your whole car has to burn out. So you can't just have a bit of a fire and drive off.
And I think so. So if I'm using it inside my house for both heating or perhaps cooking, as well, the only result of burning is water. So I presume there's a little bit of condensation or something on my pans. Are there any dangers, perhaps,
No. In fact, again, as part of the safety requirements, this has had to be proven. It is less explosive than natural gas, and the reason is it's so light, it disperses and reacts. You never get separated hydrogen in the atmosphere anyway. It very quickly combines with other things. So they've been trying to blow up a test house in Yorkshire somewhere with hydrogen for quite a while. It doesn't work, unlike natural gas, which can go up in flames. So it's highly unlikely. But there's an added bonus here. Apparently, the inability to see blue is an early sign of early onset dementia. So the blue flame that you get in your hob at the moment, often people who are beginning to suffer from dementia won't see that they've left the gas on. Now, hydrogen is colourless, so you add a colour. If they add red, people who are unable to see blue will still see the red. So there's a modest additional safety factor in there.
So the gas, you can have the hydrogen give off whatever colour you desire because...
Well, I don't know whether it would be a designer feature of your kitchen, match your flame to rainbow, your decor, but certainly, absolutely, today I quite fancy orange flames, tomorrow I'm having blue, and yesterday I had red. I don't know that that's feasible, but certainly that it will be coloured. It won't burn as a colourless flame because clearly people can't see they've left the gas on. So there is that. But a lot of people are very worried about hydrogen. They have seen the Hindenburg film where it goes up in flames. But if you look again at that film, it wasn't the hydrogen that was burning. It was the skin. The hydrogen takes quite a while before it goes up in flames. It isn't as explosive as people believe. And it's certainly no more explosive than petrol vapour. And we're quite happy putting petrol in our cars and making it explode deliberately in front of our toes in our car engines. And nobody complains about that. So this will be far safer in that respect.
So now you've painted a really great picture of what it will look like in Leeds, perhaps a city in the UK. Maybe as we start exploring them with more hydrogen cars. Could you then perhaps, do you have any thoughts on how this might scale upwards to its maximum potential use in kind of the UK and beyond? I mean, do you see a path? Like, how would you see that working?
Okay. I do have a thought for developing nations. At the moment, a lot of developing nations are attempting to replicate what we have done in the West in terms of having a centralised electricity generating scheme and then sending it out to all of the population. But in some of these very remote villages, it's almost impossible. Now, clearly, these people often have a great deal of access to solar power. Now, solar power is great as long as the sun's up, not so good in the evening. Imagine this scenario. Solar power somewhere in the remote parts, perhaps of Africa or India, and you use that to generate hydrogen. You can then use the hydrogen to generate electricity and heat or cooking without the need for wood burning stoves or frequently other fuels that are quite debilitating for health reasons. You can actually generate your own hydrogen on site in the remotest of villages, which means you have access to nighttime lighting, heating, cooking, whatever else you need. And curiously, of course, hydrogen can also then be made into fertilisers for the ground.
Another one of those.
another little serendipitous advantage that you can throw in. So actually, I see if we can talk about this to developing nations and use the technology of either wind or solar for generating hydrogen, it removes from them the need to set up these expensive infrastructure projects of mainstream electricity forms that we in the West are now rejecting. So I see that working quite well. But any country could go over to hydrogen. Japan is a great proponent. They're already way ahead of us in this respect, primarily because they have no natural resources themselves. Right. So when I was in Japan last year, I saw lots of hydrogen buses, hydrogen taxis, all sorts of things. So yes, it's definitely the way to go.
So it makes a lot of sense then, the way the UK, because of the happy accident of the way the UK has developed its energy system with its reliance on natural gas, it makes us a good candidate for transitioning to hydrogen. But then also in developing countries who don't have the infrastructure that we have in the UK, again, is another solution because it allows you to create maybe microgrids or off-grid systems, I suspect from kind of reading and researching a lot of these areas, the problems of getting kind of energy and electricity to a lot of these places in the developing world, you can't use the same solutions that we've got. You can't string up high voltage cables across the country. Those aren't working. So those are the countries that are really looking at kind of these distributed off-grid systems. To work there. And again, like hydrogen sounds like it's the right solution there.
Well, just think about how it worked with telephones. We had a cable-based phone system followed by what we've now got, which is mobiles. A lot of the developing countries leapfrogged the landline and went straight to mobiles. To an extent, I'm broadly advocating the same thing. And if we in the UK can be the drivers and the experts in hydrogen technology, both the generation of it and the use of it either in burning or in fuel cells, then we can then enable the developing world to move into these off-grid solutions that otherwise they're building huge dams and trying to put in underground cables over thousands of miles. And that's just not realistic.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's a great picture you've painted for me of a very positive, rosy world of the future working off of hydrogen. If you don't mind, I'd love to kind of talk a little bit now about your, well, I suppose first off, what got you into thinking about hydrogen in the first place and kind of what's your background in this space and what got you what got you here?
Well, to be honest, I'm not an energy professional as people might imagine. It dates way back. I actually wrote 4 books on hydrogen in 1999, and the reason for that was in the 80s I was a school teacher, taught physics in secondary schools in the UK. Then I had my daughters, and while I was at home with them, I was writing textbooks. I've written quite a lot of textbooks. And a German company who was very interested in fuel cells approached me to write a textbook, because their logic was, if we educate the young people on the potential for hydrogen, when it becomes timely, it won't be unfamiliar to them, which actually picks up your point about when you were taught about hydrogen, it was all about it burning it. So I wrote their textbook. That really got me interested. So I did 4 of these for them, still on sale if you're interested. And at that point, it suddenly became apparent to me there was more to it. Fast forward to around about 2010, I started doing a lot of work engaging underrepresented groups with science in a very formal way, whether it's women or disadvantaged groups or ethnic minority groups or white working class males. There's a lot of groups that don't get all the full range of opportunities that science could give them. And so I was always looking for topics that could engage them. And so one of them is energy and the future of energy. Now, at the time, it was very much about wind turbines. Everybody was solar and wind. And I'm saying, no, there's more to it. There's more to it. It's taken a while, but suddenly in the last 3 years, people have started listening. So I got into it through being a teacher. I moved more to talking about it because I wanted to engage young people. But now I'm talked to because I know about energy or a topic within energy that people suddenly find fascinating. So an interesting trajectory, and not one I could have predicted.
Why do you think that hydrogen has only kind of come to the fore again in recent years? Is there kind of a big political lobby? Like what's been driving the recent stuff?
In my opinion, it is 2 things. One is there's the tendency to look about to see what other people are doing without realizing they're starting from a different place. So again, we look at Germany as the epitome of a country that really is driving the green agenda, and they're strongly dependent upon wind, which is great, but they equally have a robust national grid, which we don't have, but they don't have gas, which we do have. So the assumption that the solution that suits Germany should be cut and pasted into us, actually, no, let's be more creative. So number one is looking elsewhere and assuming we should simply replicate what other people do. But the other one is there was a tendency at government level just to assume that because we have offshore wind, that must be the solution. There are so many reasons why it cannot on its own solve the problem. And so I started lobbying what was then BIS, Department for Business, Industry and Skills, in probably 2015, 2016, to say we need to look at the hydrogen. And yes, they've started to come around. And now, although it's not in the headlines, the government is funding a lot of projects to determine the feasibility of hydrogen, the acceptability amongst the public, and working with this Leeds project. So it may be under the radar, but it doesn't mean nothing is happening. And I can promise anyone who's listening to this, if they Google hydrogen heating or something similar, you'll get more hits than you could imagine.
Oh, interesting. It sounds like the lobby group was you.
Amongst others, but I did my bit, and I also, every time I give a public lecture, which is quite often, I do then send the individuals away saying, right, what you've got to do is lobby your MP on this. So I'm using this cascade effect to try to get people talking about it, because to be honest, as soon as anyone listens to the story I'm telling, they suddenly say, but this makes so much sense. Well, go and tell people about it. And then people say, I hadn't realized, I need to know more. Much has happened to you when we chatted a couple of weeks ago.
Brilliant. Yeah, no, that's exactly how I feel about it right now. I'm quite excited about hydrogen. I think I'm going to do a lot more research into it in the future. So another question I like to ask people, especially people like yourself who've been in this space for just a really long time, and it sounds like you've been battling skeptics for a really long time as well. I'd love to find out, you know, how do you stay motivated through all of these, perhaps all the no's and through all this past? Like, what are your skills in that regard?
Okay, so I'm frequently asked to give talks at schools or universities on careers and particularly prize givings and degree givings. So I've thought about this quite a lot, because they always ask me the same thing, you know, how did you get to where you are? What keeps you going? And I've decided it all comes down to snakes and ladders, the game of snakes and ladders. Because, of course, when these young people, if I'm talking to young people, they always talk about the career ladder, as if you step on the bottom of the career ladder and you work your way up and it's just a matter of how far you go. Frankly, that's not true. I know life is not about a career ladder. Life is a game of snakes and ladders. And the trick is this.
Just to describe the game, because it's a game where you go up.
That's right. So you're going along and you hit the bottom of a ladder, and you're allowed to climb the ladder for a short distance. So you have benefited from landing on that opportunity. You then go along and you hit the head of a snake, and it brings you all the way down, possibly to lower than you were before, and you feel very despondent. So as a child's game, it's a matter of working your way to the top, to square number 100. But you encounter the benefits of a ladder or the problems of a snake at various points in the game. Life is like that. You will hit ladders. You will have opportunities. You will climb a little way. You'll carry on. You'll hit a disappointment. It's the job you didn't get, the promotion you didn't get, the project that didn't work out, the person who said no. You slide down that metaphorical snake to somewhere lower than you were before. But this is the point. There's always another ladder. Always look round. There's always another ladder, and it will take you to higher than you were before. And if you keep it in mind that every time you hit a snake, it's because it's taking you to the bottom of a better ladder, you will keep climbing. So it's always the way. There will be barriers. It's not about getting over them. It's about looking round and finding the other way up. And if I feel I am benefiting somebody, giving them an opportunity they wouldn't otherwise have, that's what motivates me.
I love that. That's a great... I feel that's good advice for me also. And it reminds me of one of my sayings, which is there's always a bigger fish. So if you get blocked in one way, just search around. There's always a bigger fish. There's always a bigger ladder somewhere to help you up. I love that. That's great. It's very motivational. And just to end the podcast, is there anything inspirational, something you've read recently, a person our listeners should follow, a thought you've had, just something you want to leave the audience with before we leave?
Oh, only the snakes and ladders, if I'm honest. Yes. All I can say is that there are numerous things I wish I had been told when I was 16. So if I'm going to offer listeners an inspirational thing, what I will say is this. Think of a woman that they know, a woman particularly. It is a bit sexist, I know, but I don't care. Think of a woman they know that they admire, older than them. It might be their mum, their grandma, their aunt, an older cousin, an older sister, whoever. And ask them this question. If you could time travel and you could go back and you could meet your 16-year-old self, what advice would you give to your 16-year-old self? And whatever advice comes back, that's the advice I would give to your listeners.
Very self-reflective advice. Yeah. I love it. Yeah.
And I've done this on groups that I've worked on workshops with over and over again. And the advice that comes back from these women is so brilliant. So I don't need to give anybody any advice. They all have a resource that they can tap into to give them advice. Ask them what they'd say to themselves as a 16-year-old self and take it on board.
You've been listening to Asim Hussain on The Climate Fix. If you like what you heard, please hit subscribe on your favourite podcast application. It really does help.
Information about this episode, including all the links that we mentioned, can be found on our website, theclimatefix.com. If you want to message me, you can find me on Twitter as Jawache, or you can email me at hello@theclimatefix.com. Till next time.